Sunday afternoon, and time once again for Wordplay. And we are pleased and privileged once again to be joined in the studio by North Carolina's very own poet laureate, Kathy Smith Bowers. And Kathy has a special guest today, Charlotte writer Jim McGavran. Kathy, take it away.
Thank you, Jefferson Davis, for sharing this hour of Wordplay, and many, many thanks to the North Carolina Arts Council for making this Laureate's Hour possible. I'm delighted to have as our guest today author Jim McGavran. Jim teaches English literature at UNC Charlotte and is the editor of two collections of essays on Romanticism and children's literature. And now, lucky for us lovers of literary nonfiction, Jim has written a gorgeous memoir just out from Michigan State University Press, a memoir titled In the Shadow of the Bear. Welcome, Jim McGavran.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Jim, the title alludes to a literal geographical location, the sleeping bear, but very soon we're captivated by the metaphorical world of the sleeping bear. Could you start by talking about the literal sleeping bear?
Sure. The literal sleeping bear is the Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore, formerly known as the Sleeping Bear Sand Dunes. When I was a boy of about 8, my parents first started taking me and my brother and sister up to this part of Michigan, northwestern Lower Michigan, Leelanau County, west of Grand Traverse Bay, for our 2-week annual summer vacation, the first 2 weeks of August every year. It was all the time off that my father got from his editing job in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And so we started, I think, going up there in 1949. Mm-hmm. And we kept going for at least 10 or 11 years, at least till I graduated from high school in 1959. And I might have gone back just once in my college years, but after that, I don't think I was there for something like 40 years. I might never have gone back, except that in 1999, our daughter Kathy moved from Charlotte, where we live, to Ann Arbor, Michigan, just to start a new life. And so then we had a reason to go to Michigan, just to see her. Well, now Ann Arbor is about 5 hours southeast from where I used to go on my vacations. But after my mother died early in 2001, my wife Deej and I decided that not only would we go to visit Kathy, but we would make the additional drive up to northwestern Lower Michigan to Leelanau County and see the place that I really only dimly remembered from my childhood vacations. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah.
So we went, and we drove into town, the town of Empire, sort of at the south edge of Leelanau County, and I was just absolutely overwhelmed. I laughed, I cried, I went through I don't know how many different kinds of emotions. I saw the grocery store that had been there 50 years before, Deering's Market. It was still there. Mm. Right next to it in the same building was the Friendly Tavern where my parents used to play shuffleboard.
Was it still friendly?
It was very friendly. They do very nice sandwiches, including a nice veggie burger if you're off of meats. Uh-huh. But I didn't know that at first, but I just couldn't believe it. And we drove on down to the end of the street, and I suddenly remembered just how to turn to get to the beach road. Mm. So we drove to the beach, and there was Lake Michigan, where it had always been. And to the left, I could see the Empire Bluffs, and to the right, I could see the beginnings of the sand dunes, the Sleeping Bear. And I started looking for stones along the beach because that was something we always did mm-hmm. when we were kids. We especially liked to collect the ones that were heart-shaped. So I found one that was heart-shaped and red, gave it to Deej. So that was really the beginning of my desire to write about this. I should say that since about the mid-90s, I had been teaching nature writing classes mm-hmm. at UNC Charlotte. And that I sort of got into that from being a Wordsworthian and the great 19th century British poet of nature and spirit. And once I had this natural and spiritual experience of going back to Empire, back to Leelanau, I thought, well, you know, I've been talking the talk. Now it's time to walk the walk. So the next year we had a big family reunion. My brother and sister and all of their families came, and we were all there together, and that triggered more memories and sharing of memories. And then it was about that time that I actually started writing. And the following summer, I received a summer research grant from my campus, from UNC Charlotte, so that Deej and I could stay up there a whole month and I could interview a whole lot of people to get better historical and cultural and even business-type bearings on the place. So over a period of, I guess, 6 years anyway, from 03 to 09, when the book was accepted for publication, I spent a great deal of time on it. I managed to write a couple of other scholarly essays, one of which got published and one of which didn't. But the main focus of my research time, when I had the time, was working on this book. And it really did take that long. I had no idea that it would be published or that it would be published mm-hmm. in Michigan. I'm so happy about that. I can hardly stand it, but that's the way that worked out.
Well, I think that Michigan State University Press was very wise because this, I love literary nonfiction. I think it's, you know, it's sort of like a combination of poetry and prose, and this book has all of the wonderful elements of really good literary nonfiction. So I'm glad you decided to walk the walk.
Thank
Jim,
you.
Really, this is such a beautiful book. There was a legend about why the Sleeping Bear was called Sleeping Bear, and you have a beautiful passage in the book. Would you read that to us?
I'd be glad to. Yes, it's an Ojibwe legend that has been told and retold a number of times. The version of it I use is quoted from another Leelanau writer, Anne-Marie Ooman is her name, and I'm just quoting that out of my book, but I think she tells it very succinctly. The great she-bear, Mishi Mokwa, left the shores of Wisconsin with her two cubs and swam across Lake Michigan. When she pulled herself onto the shore here in Michigan, she turned back to call the cubs, but they slipped in exhaustion under the waves and were drowned. She was so filled with grief, she tore open a place in the land, then in her own exhaustion fell asleep watching for them to return. The Great Spirit sent a golden wind which covered her with sand. She sleeps still, watching and waiting for her cubs. Because their journey had been so valiant, the Great Spirit raised the cubs and changed them into two beautiful islands and named them after himself, North and South Manitou. So it's a story about motherhood, and it's a story about struggle, and it's a story about how mothers and parents generally try both to love and support their children at the same time to challenge them and to teach them and to get them to reach further. And this one ends very tragically, if the Great Spirit hadn't intervened. Originally, up to about mid-20th century, there was a small dune on top of the big sand dunes that was specifically thought to resemble a bear, especially if you saw it from a boat on Lake Michigan. But erosion, caused partly by Dunesmobile cars, which were these big, well, they weren't big, but they were like Ford convertibles or Oldsmobile convertibles with big fat sand tires on them. They always drove up to see the Sleeping Bear Dune, and the dune just has eroded terribly. But in the meantime, the whole area, not just the old state park, but now the whole national lakeshore, bears that name. So the legend, the geographical significance of these dunes as the largest moving sand dunes east of the Mississippi, visible even by astronauts from space, the legend goes on. And it certainly is the main geographical attraction of this area, along with the beaches, the cherry orchards, the forests, and all the rest of this beautiful place.
Jim, would you also, from at the end of that first section, I want our audience to get a feel for your beautiful prose voice. So how about reading to us the final paragraph in that, that part one?
Sure. Whatever joy or pain we know in life, the stories we tell about the people and places we love can flow like water, like the wind, like blood that courses through us with every beat of our hearts, reviving us, sometimes even changing us, as the Sleeping Bear legend changes our understanding of the dunes, as Leelanau changed my mother and father, and as I feel myself changed by catching a few bright memory fish such as these I have been sharing. Armed with stories, with the wizardry of language, I proceed both forward and backward, struggling to become a cartographer of the past as I steady my gaze into those Leelanau waters, so brilliant and often so deep.
That's just gorgeous language. Just gorgeous.
Thank you,
Jim.
Thank you very much.
And that's just a taste of the beauty of this prose throughout. So, Jim, part two of the book begins, as you were reading that passage about the myth of the sleeping bear, and you get to that part about the mother when she pulled the great she-bear, left the shores of Wisconsin with her two cubs and swam across Lake Michigan. And that is, as we move into part two of this book, we can hear an echo of that. This mother bear has two cubs. This mother bear, the idea of the bear becomes metaphorical as we move into part two, called Shadowing Mom. And if that mother bear had had three cubs,
it could have been my mother and sister.
Absolutely. Yeah. This part two is dedicated to your mother, as complex and intriguing as any fictional character a novelist might create. So congratulations, Jim, on on making this book as compelling as a fine novel. Talk to us about the mother that you shine a light on and all of her complexities.
Well, I think she was an extremely complex woman, and she is the parallel is between my mother and Mishimakwa, the sleeping bear. My mother was a big woman. She was tall and big boned and strong, and not overweight, not heavy in the way you might picture a bear, but she was a strong, very dominant kind of person, and she played many roles in our house. She was a great cook. She liked to sew. She made pottery for a while. Mm-hmm. She kept a beautiful garden. She went to great books meetings. She read, and she loved to go out and have a good time. There were a whole lot of different sides to her, and she was very poured into all those different roles. She really hated the feminine mystique when it came out. She couldn't mm-hmm. forgive Betty Friedan because she didn't feel that her life was being, I don't know, limited, circumscribed by male domination or anything. She found a lot to do, and she did it, and she enjoyed her life very much. She had another side to her, which was that she could be very sensitive sometime about small things, and sometimes she could get angry very quickly. I tell in the book one place where, you know, she'd get mad at us if we were sitting around indoors on a day and we were yeah. playing cards or reading. And you need to get outside and get some fresh air and sunshine. You won't grow up right. So then we'd go outside and play, and then she'd come and yell at us to come back in the house because we were making too much noise. She would get into those moods, and she would sometimes say that her nerves were bothering her. Mm. And in the book, I talk about how Mrs. Bennet in Jane Austen's classic Pride and Prejudice would complain that her nerves were bothering her. And, of course, Mr. Bennet says that they'd bothered him quite a bit over a good many years. This did not bother my father. My father dealt with this. And besides, she never showed this kind of emotion towards him. She loved him very, very mm-hmm. deeply.
In my mind, I'm going to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Oh, I'm going to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's a silver sun. You best walk her away and watch it shine. Watch her, watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now while I'm crying. Ain't I gone? Soft and kind. And hey, baby, the sky's on fire. I'm dying. Ain't I gone to Carolina in my mind? you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind till I'm gone to Carolina in my mind? Dark and silent late last night, I think we might have heard the highway calling. Peace in flight and dogs advised. Signs in my biome and say I'm going, I'm going, gone to Carolina in my mind. It's with a holy host of others standing around me. Still I'm on the dark side of the moon, and it looks like on like this forever, oh, you must forgive me. If I'm gone, Carolina in my mind. By mine, I'm long gone to Carolina. Can't you see sunshine? I said, can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine just to hit me from behind till I'm gone to Carolina in my mind? Oh, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
Listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and let's return now to our discussion with Jim McGavern.
There's so many passages that I would love for you to, you know, to be able to read, and but, you know, we do see this woman who could be absolutely delightful and creative, and she could be also could be very hard and angry, and she could be hilarious and compassionate. One of my favorite scenes or stories is the what I call the nice egg episode. So I would love for you to read some of that for our audience.
Oh, I'd be glad to. This was something we all still laugh about all the time whenever we talk about it, a legend in our family. I'll begin reading. It's on page 46. Year after year during our school days, Mom asked us every morning at breakfast whether we wanted a nice egg. I know why she did it. I knew it even then. She loved us and wanted the whole world to know it. Unlike certain slatternly mothers, she could and often did mention by name. She rose with her children every day to get them off to school with a good breakfast inside them. And once up and dressed, she wanted to be more than the silent witness of our juice gulping and milk spills. She wanted to be actively engaged in promoting our welfare. Fred, kinder to her on this issue than I, went for the egg more often. But I never thought there was anything very nice about a yolk leering up at me from the plate, so I almost always held out for a bowl of Kix or Cheerios or Raisin Bran. Besides, I love to mail in quarters taped to cereal box tops and then stalk the mailbox for weeks until the promised toy appeared. But as time passed, I began to hear both pain and a hint of menace behind Mom's repeated offer. So I would say yes to an egg once in a while and chew lots of toast while the egg bites were in my mouth to minimize their egginess. My anti-feminist, anti-egg paranoia was latent in those halcyon days. It has since blossomed, as Deej, my wife, knows only too well, into a theory that women deliberately tempt the men in their lives with eggs in order to jack up their cholesterol and eventually kill them. Looking back now, I can see how inevitable it was that Fred and I both began to tease Mom about her use of the expression, nice egg. Naturally, she resented this baiting, and naturally, Fred and I were too dumb to do anything but escalate it once we saw how effective it was. Pipe down and no back talk began to be heard more frequently at breakfast time. I don't remember which of us first realized that a potential of a mockery of eggs that would also ignite her suspicions regarding the Church of Rome. We were Presbyterians. But sooner or later, it had to happen. One of us, Fred says it was me, called her to her face, Our Lady of the Nice Egg. Well, this provoked a terrible fury, which I will not attempt to describe, except to note Mom's enraged insistence that she was not, nor would she ever suffer herself to become, Our Lady of anything. Sometime later, after I had spent my year in France, I could make Fred giggle nervously if we were at home together by whispering under my breath, Notre Dame de l'œuf gentil, but I never dared say this out loud to Mom. Besides, it sounded even dumber in French.
She should have smacked both of you. That is just delightful. You know, so here you are, an author, and your brother Fred. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we could see in these passages, you know, that there were two authors just waiting to pop out.
Yes, my brother Fred is a far more published author than I am. Fred has been writing short stories for years. He's been working on a novel more recently. He's won awards. One of his short stories won the Raymond Carver Award for Short Fiction, which is a big award put out by Humboldt State University in California, where Carver worked for so long. And my brother has also recently published a wonderful collection of short stories called The Butterfly Collector, just a wonderful collection. So Fred deserves at least as much mention as I do, I think, here. But I guess we were... you know, both in our own ways, reacting with memories and language to a lot of things.
Yeah. Wow. We could spend the rest of the time on the section on your mother. It's just absolutely, I mean, there are moments in there that just are heartbreaking, too. And, but we've got, as we move into part three of the book, that's where you begin to devote some space to your father. And that, too, you carry out that motif of the shadow. What is that? What's the title of that?
Chapter three is called Shadows of Dad. The way this worked out was that initially, anyway, and I explain this in Chapter 3, it was harder for me to come up with specific memories of my father. He was always, or at least nearly always, a fairly quiet man, especially in a lot of company. We just didn't hear as much from him most of the time, even at home. He was a very loving and supportive father, don't misunderstand me, but he was not, as I say in the book, a very demonstrative father. In terms of directly showing his affection. We, the McGaverns, though, as a family, were very, very funny. Whenever we got together with my father's family, aunts and uncles and cousins, we just laughed all the time because we just told jokes on ourselves. The whole jokes about the McGaverns were how we always sort of mess things up and don't do things right. There is even according to our old family Bible, there was one McGavran who emigrated over here from Ireland and then apparently couldn't stand it and went back. He was not full of the spirit of the plow that broke the plane or the New World Symphony or anything that might have excited Dvorak. And so that we tell a lot of stories on ourselves. And that was a whole side of my father that we came to know and love, but it took a little while. So he was sort of in the shadow of my mother, in a way. That was sort of the meaning of the title of this story. Mm-hmm. But he was very, very clever. He too was a writer professionally, an editor, and So maybe my brother and I got some of our, if not our ability to write, at least our desire mm-hmm. to write for him. I know he would be so proud of Fred and me if he could know what we've done.
Oh, wow, wow. Jim, there's this one sentence that I think mm-hmm. is so moving on page 71 at the okay. end of that middle paragraph. He was everywhere and nowhere, present but elusive, as if in Mom's shadow. That's he it. Was never a soldier, but in my mind, he had gone missing in action. Right. And yet, on page 77, here is a passage that I'm not sure you'll be able to do it. Jim's oh. tearing up here and making me tear up.
Oh.
It's just such a moving book. But that the bathtub scene.
I'll try. That,
okay.
Jim, yeah.
if you get to the place where you can't continue, I'll pick right up
okay.
for you.
Okay, that'll be great.
Okay.
He didn't always withdraw, I reflect. Now it's bedtime at home in Columbus. I sit in the bathtub behind Fred. This had to have happened in the 40s when we were still small enough to fit into the tub together. It's hot and steamy in the small bathroom, and Dad is bathing us. He has taken off his tie and rolled up the sleeves of the white shirt he wore to work. On his knees, he leans over the tub. He washes our faces and rinses them quickly before the soap can get into our eyes and sting. We take turns sliding the slippery bar of Kirk's Castile soap over ourselves. This always makes us giggle. Still laughing, we pass it to Dad so he can wash our backs. Then he does something wonderful. He does it every night, but it never gets boring. He gathers the corners of the washcloth into a soft, soggy bowl, fills it with warm water from the tub, and pours it down our backs to rinse us off. He usually does Fred first. I don't like watching and waiting, but it is also nice to be last. I love the trick of turning the cloth into a bowl, and I love the warmth of the bathwater on my back. Most of all, I love the attention my father is paying to me. I wait for him to do it again, and he usually does, but just once. If I ask for another turn, he says no.
And Jim, you on page 78, you move up to the time when you and DG, my fond name for your wife.
Yes.
So would you read that passage about you bathing
sure.
your own children?
Sure. I tried to follow Dad's example, and I completely messed up. Years later, when I bathed my own children at bedtime, I also gathered the edges of the washcloth, but my bowls were leaky and never deep enough to hold much water, and the kids probably wondered why I even attempted such an odd thing. Like Dad, I told them stories that neither they nor I remember. Then I tucked them into bed and prayed with them. No big deal, just now I lay me, though we upgraded to the Lord's Prayer as they got older. Then, just as he did, I pulled up the covers, turned out the light, and left the room. One thing I did that he didn't, I kissed them goodnight. Our sons, Mark and Jamie, as well as our daughter, Kathy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm.
Wow. What? Just so beautiful. Just so beautiful. So...
bid farewell to the state of old New York, my home away from home. In the state of New York, I came of age when first I started roaming. And the trees grow high. Must I follow? Won't you stay? rise up over the Rockies and down on him to California. Out to where, but the rocks remain. And let the sun set on the ocean.
Listening to Wordplay, I'm your host Jeff Davis, and now back to our discussion with Jim McGavern.
Saw parts 1, 2, and 3,
mm-hmm.
And that's where I am right now in this wonderful book, and I'm actually glad I haven't finished it because I'm, you know, I have more that I get to read, and I'm hoping that our audience will order this book. It's so beautiful. But what do you do in the next few sections of the book?
Sure, there are 5 chapters in all. So the dad chapter is the 3rd one. The 4th chapter is called Concerts, Crossings, Kinship, Love. So we're going away from the close look at my parents and into other stories about my family. This is where I tell quite a lot about the McGaverns and try to bring out a lot of our sort of crazy humor. I talk a lot about my mother's Thanksgiving dinners. My mother was the chief cook when we had Thanksgiving dinner at mm-hmm. our house for all the McGaverns that were in Columbus, and that frequently added up to between 15 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember... and realize with a more of an adult recognition how hard she worked for that. My aunts helped her in the kitchen and brought food of their own that they had fixed at their own houses. But my mother always did the turkey, the mashed potatoes, the stuffing, and all of that. And she loved to do it. I mean, it was something she was really good at, and she liked to do it. And we had just wonderful times at those Thanksgiving dinners and some funny things happened there, too. One of them happened to my great uncle, the physician that we all called Uncle Doctor. Uncle Doctor was a brilliant man. He mm-hmm. had studied medicine in Germany back before World War I, and at a time when, I guess, few physicians from Ohio, anyway, would have gone there. He was a brilliant diagnostician, I guess the house of his time. And yet, unlike the other McGaverns, he had very little sense of humor. He had married a woman who was known as a great beauty in her youth, but Aunt Flora developed into one of those retiring delicate ladies who was always a little bit ailing. And I think that maybe that was her way of getting the attention of her doctor husband. Right. I'm not sure. But... they never had any children. My grandfather and grandmother had 5 children and very little money. But Uncle Doctor and Aunt Flora had the money but no kids. They befriended my dad a lot. They took him on a Mediterranean cruise with them once when he was in his college years. They were very generous to him. But they always sort of wanted you to know that they were the ones with the money who could do things for people. And this is partly maybe just that we were a little bit, you know, we were jealous of him because mm-hmm. he was very successful, you know, in his profession, and he certainly made a lot of money. But at one of the most memorable Thanksgiving parties, one of my aunts accidentally, I think, she was putting Ready Whip onto his pumpkin pie, and the surface tension on the pumpkin pie could not stand the blast from the Ready Whip can, and the pumpkin pie and the Ready Whip shot all over Uncle Doctor, his face, his eyeglasses, his necktie, and we didn't see this because the children were eating in a different room from the adults, and adults kept coming into where we were eating and laughing hysterically, and we couldn't get them to tell us what had happened because they were laughing too hard. And then what happened was that another aunt decided she would try to help Uncle Doctor by wiping him off, so she brought a glass of water up close to him and a napkin, and then she managed to upset the water glass right into his lap so that the rinse experience...
All right, now, Jim, I think you're making this up.
I don't know. The rinse experience...
We've moved from from nonfiction into fiction now, right?
No, this really happened. This is one of the great McGavern stories. And, of course, we were forbidden to go into the room where he was because Uncle Doctor was incapable of laughing at himself about anything like this. So we just had to stifle our laughter the way you do when you want to laugh in church at something, you know. So, but that kind of tells you something about. And my grandfather was the one who told stories, and maybe that's where my dad and Fred and I both got it. My grandfather loved to tell stories and tall tales, mm-hmm. really tall tales. Mm-hmm. About the time he rode the lion into St. Petersburg. That was St. Petersburg, Russia. And but he was a great talker. And,
right.
So I think that's where a lot of it was.
Well, then part five is homecoming. So
yeah,
this is...
that's a short chapter. It tells a little bit more about the part of Leelanau where Deej and I stay now, and some history of some of the earlier settlements. Mm-hmm. The first Europeans to come to Leelanau were mostly French trappers. They were mm-hmm. hunting for furs. Then there was this huge wave of people, lumber people, because it was totally, you know, original forest. And they, you know, pretty stupidly cut a lot of it down. But there were all kinds of little lumber communities, usually right on Lake Michigan, so that the lumber could be mm-hmm. picked up in boats and shipped, you know, down the lake, maybe to Chicago or wherever. And so I found out about that. But I also tell the story of one current Leelanau family, the Eitzens, whose farm and cherry orchards are very, very close to where DG and I stay, and how they had agreed to give their land up to the National Lakeshore. This has been a divisive issue for Leelanau people. The National Lakeshore owns a great deal of property now, and that is very good because they can not only control the stability of the dunes themselves, but they can control development in the surrounding area so that it won't just get totally overdeveloped, mm-hmm. say the way that North Carolina's Outer Banks right. have been overdeveloped in the last 20 or 30 years. But some of the local landowners were very bitter about the way the land was taken. It was not like out west where, you know, great huge areas were staked out to be national parks that had not previously mm-hmm. Been settled, but they had to take land from people. Well, the Eitzens orchards are very, very close to where we live, and we started buying cherries from their cherry stand. And the thing I end the whole book with is an incident where I just by chance met Mrs. Eitzen, matriarch of the family, since her husband had died several years before. And I was about to put $3 into a little trust box and walk away with a pint of beautiful dark cherries that were just fresh. And mm-hmm. I saw this car come up, and I thought, oh, they're coming to get the cherries. And but I've got these. I paid for them. They're the last ones. But no, it was Mrs. Eitzen, although I didn't know it at first. I heard this voice calling out, wait, don't take those. I have some that are even fresher. And so she got mm-hmm. out of her car, this mm-hmm. beautiful, tall, straight, white-haired lady with beautiful eyes, and I said, are you Mrs. Eitzen? She said, yes, and I just started chatting her up the way a freshman would talk to the prom queen or the homecoming queen. Mm-hmm. And I was so nervous, I don't think I ever even told her my name, but I told her we had come to this area, we had read about her family in the local newspaper, and a lot of sympathy, and we loved the cherries, and just loved being here, and she was very nice and listened to me, and I went home and told Deej that I had met her, and I really didn't know what it meant. But later I realized that she kind of finally banished all the ghosts of Leelanau for me. She was a real woman. She was kind. She was generous. She offered me even fresher fruit than the cherries I was going to take. Mm-hmm. And I think the last sentence in the whole book is she wasn't a ghost. She was real.
Mm. Oh, Jim. Jim, what can we look forward to as far as readings, as far as how this book is going to be put out there, and
sure.
what's happening?
Well, a couple of things are happening. I have a signing scheduled for Saturday, December 11th at 1 p.m., at Park Road Books in Charlotte. That's in the Park Road Shopping Center at the corner of Park and Woodlawn. I'm very excited about that. I've always thought that you really made it as a writer in Charlotte if you can have a signing at Park Ridge Books. And,
Frank's going to love that.
Well, Frank is the one. Yeah. I've talked with Sally, too, and I just reconfirmed it this week, so I'm very much looking forward to that. The other thing is that my son Jamie is engaged to a wonderful young woman named Sherry Braden, and her sister Marcy has designed a website for me to publicize the book. So you can actually go into your browser and type in jimmcgavran.com, mm-hmm. and it will come up. And there are some of the pictures that are in the book, the nostalgia.
I'm glad you mentioned those, because the middle of the book has just this wonderful collection of photographs that just really do enhance the beauty of the story that you're telling.
Well, I was so glad that Michigan State would let me do the photos. I think that when people are reading about other people's actual lives, they love to see.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something we'd love to. Or even if you're just at a friend's house having a drink or something, mm-hmm. and they go out of the room, you start prowling
That's
around
right.
looking at all the pictures they have out, the albums, even if you think you have time. So I was really happy about that. But some of those old pictures are on the website, and they're identified. And then there's some new pictures, too, actually photos that I've taken up there just to show some of the beauty of the place, the forest. There's one of a cherry orchard. There's one of Lake Michigan where you can see, I think it's North Manitou Island. People that haven't been up to that part of the country may think that that all Michigan is old deserted car factories, but that's not true. There's just some beautiful, beautiful scenery around the Great Lakes. Like the state of Michigan has more miles of coastline than California.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's all freshwater, but it's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a sort of a flavor of that from looking at the website, and it gives a little information about me and about the book, and it will post additional, if I have additional signings or anything like
mm-hmm.
that, it will be on there. I am hoping to have another signing in February on the UNC Charlotte campus,
mm-hmm.
at the Barnes & Noble campus
mm-hmm.
bookstore. I've been negotiating with that too, so I'm very excited about that as well.
We'll have a lot of fun, and
so.
Because you deserve it. This is a beautiful work. It was 7 years in the making. Probably all your life in the making, though.
True.
True. And it's beautiful, Jim. Would you read us one more passage of your choosing from anywhere in the book?
I'll try to read a passage from chapter one about the time that my mother took us fishing. I start it with a beautiful, well, I think it's a beautiful quotation from Thoreau, from Walden, and then I go on to give a kind of an ironic response, partly ironic. Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. I drink at it, but while I drink, I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper. Fish in the sky, whose bottom is pebbly with stars.
Mm-hmm.
With words as his fishing line, Thoreau seems effortlessly to connect earth and heaven, time and eternity. Following his transcendental hint, I continue my memories with a fishing trip. A bit perversely, since I don't like to fish and haven't done so more than once or twice since this excursion at Little Glen Lake well over half a century ago. The last time I tried it, I paid too many tourist dollars to take our son Mark trolling an Albemarle Sound just inside the Outer Banks. I got seasick and spewed Coca-Cola all over the deck of the boat to my own disgust and that of the crew, while with grace and tact, Mark ignored his wretched father and hauled in several excellent bluefish, which D.G. pan-fried for dinner that night. With apologies to Michigan fishing writers from Jerry Dennis to Jim McVeigh, this Leonov official fishing trip was not about father-son male bonding. It was not Dad, but my mother who got us up early one morning to go fishing before breakfast. Daybreak was the moment she told us when the perch and bass in Little Glen would be most likely to bite. So we bundled up in jeans and jackets against the dawn chill. trooped down to the dock and clambered into the rowboat. Mom, Fred, and I took turns rowing, Mom first. My father, who didn't enjoy fishing any more than I did, stayed at the Ritz with Molly. The Ritz was the name of our cottage. When it was my turn, Mom said to try to row very gently and quietly to avoid scaring the fish. Clumsy as I was, I rowed noisily, even managing to bang an oar against the side of the boat. I was repelled by both the abstract concept and the physical reality of attaching a worm to a fish hook. Fred was highly attracted to this same idea and activity. We must have scared the fish, because we didn't catch many. Fred got one or two, but Mom pronounced that they were too small to be keepers and threw them back into Little Glen. At the time, it seemed a botched excursion. I was disappointed, embarrassed about my physical awkwardness, and sleepy from having gotten up so early. But all that fades out of mind now, and I remember the early morning quiet on the lake, the tall marsh grass under the shadow of the trees along the shore, the mist rising as the morning brightened, the great dunes becoming visible above the tree line to the left, and to the right, the alligator, the forested hill of reptilian profile that separates Little Glen Lake from Big Glen, where richer people owned or rented bigger summer houses. And I remember my mother's beauty and authority as she led this expedition, determined, I see now, to set it like a jewel in the platinum haze of the morning and hand it to us to keep. If she could only know how well she taught us. It wasn't just about fishing. It wasn't even mostly about fishing. But is fishing ever really mostly about fishing? It was about self-control and learning how to do things right, things God knows I still need lessons in. And it was about honoring the beauty of the world, the life we are given, and the places we live it in.
Wow. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Thanks. That was one of the first passages I wrote, actually.
I'm so glad you read that. That'll be perfect. Yeah.
This is one of the first passages I wrote in the whole book. I mean, this was one of the first early memories that came back to me so clear. That, and of course, remembering my mother telling me how to climb the sand dunes, not to get out of breath, which I talk about a lot.
And you couldn't run because your feet would go.
That your feet would sink in and you'd be out of breath and you'd have a heart attack and all of that. But I have always remembered that fishing trip and how uncomfortable I was, but what a gorgeous thing it was. It was a jewel. It still sparkles.
I'm so glad you read that.
Shining from shook foil, can't
you? Like shining from shook foil, yes. Jim McGavran, author of the brand new In the Shadow of the Bear, published by Michigan State University Press. Jim, thank you so much for this book, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I just so look forward to continuing reading this gorgeous book.
Thanks. It was great fun, a great pleasure to be here.
Great.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay?
That is Wordplay for this week. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Thanks so much to Kathy Smith Bowers. Indeed, that was such a wonderful show. Yeah. And we'll see you next week. If you need more information about today's show, try naturespoetry.blogspot.com. And thanks for listening, as always.
I could only work this life out my way. I'd rather spend it to you, but you're so